in two. My years of struggling against inequality, abusive power, poverty, oppression, and injustice had finally revealed something to me about myself. Being close to suffering, death, and cruel punishments didn't just illuminate the brokenness of others. In a moment of anguish and heartbreak, it also exposed my own brokenness. You can't effectively fight abusive power, poverty, inequality, illness, oppression, or injustice and not be broken by it. We are all broken by something. We have all hurt someone and have been hurt. We all share the condition of brokenness, even if our brokenness is not equivalent. I desperately wanted mercy for Jimmy Dill and would have done anything to create justice for him, but I couldn't pretend that his struggle was disconnected from my own. The ways in which I have been hurt and have hurt others are different from the ways Jimmy Dill suffered and caused suffering, but our shared brokenness connected us. I guess I'd always known but never fully considered that being broken is what makes us human. We all have our reasons. Sometimes we're fractured by the choices we make. Sometimes we're shattered by things out of our control. But our brokenness is also the source of our common humanity, the basis for our shared search for comfort, meaning, and healing. Our shared vulnerability and imperfection is what gives us each our capacity for compassion. We have a choice. We can embrace our humanness, which means embracing our broken natures and the compassion that remains our best hope for healing. Or we can deny our brokenness, deny compassion, and as a result, deny our own humanity. I thought of the guard strapping Jimmy Dill to the gurney that very hour. I thought of the people who would cheer his death and see it as some kind of victory. I realized they were broken people too, even if they would never admit it. So many of us have become afraid and angry. We've become so fearful and vengeful that we've thrown away children, discarded the disabled, and allowed the imprisonment of the sick and the weak, not because they are a threat to public safety or beyond rehabilitation, but because we think it makes us seem tough, less broken. I thought of the victims of violent crime and the survivors of murdered loved ones, and how we've pressured them to recycle their anguish and give it back to the offenders we prosecute. I thought of the many ways we've legalized vengeful and cruel punishments, how we've allowed our victimization to justify the victimization of others. But punishing the broken, whether it's by walking away from them or hiding them from sight, only ensures that they remain broken, and that we do too. I frequently had difficult conversations with clients who were struggling and despairing over their situations. Whenever things got really bad and they were questioning the value of their lives, I would remind them that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I told them that if someone tells a lie, that person is not just a liar. If you take something that doesn't belong to you, you're not just a thief. Even if you kill someone, you're not just a killer. So I told myself that evening what I'd been telling my clients for years. I am more than broken. In fact, there is a strength, a power even, in understanding brokenness. Embracing our brokenness creates a desire for mercy, and perhaps a need to show mercy to others too. When you experience mercy, you begin to recognize the humanity that resides in each of us. All of a sudden, I felt stronger. I began thinking about what would happen if we all just acknowledged our brokenness, if we owned up to our weaknesses, our shortcomings, our biases, our fears. Maybe if we did, we wouldn't want to kill the broken among us who have killed others. Maybe we would look harder for solutions to caring for the disabled, the abused, the neglected, and the traumatized. If we acknowledged our brokenness, perhaps we would no longer take pride in mass incarceration, in executing people, in treating our most vulnerable peers with indifference. I looked at the clock. It was 6:30 p.m. Mr. Dill was dead by now. I was very tired, and it was time to stop all this foolishness about quitting. It was time to be brave. As I slowly made my way home, I understood that even as we are caught in a web of hurt and brokenness, were also in a web of healing and mercy. I thought of the little boy with the stutter who hugged me outside of church, creating reconciliation and love. I didn't deserve reconciliation or love in that moment, but that's how mercy works. The power of just mercy is that it belongs to the undeserving. It's when mercy is least expected that it's most powerful, strong enough to break the cycle of victimization and victimhood, retribution and suffering. It has the power to heal the psychic harm and injuries that lead to aggression and violence, abuse of power, mass incarceration. I left the office broken and brokenhearted about Jimmy Dill, but I knew I would come back the next day. There was more work to do. Chapter 16. The Stonecatcher's Song of Sorrow. On May 17, 2010, I was sitting in my office waiting anxiously when the United States Supreme Court announced its decision. Sentences of life imprisonment without parole imposed on children convicted of non-homicide crimes is cruel and unusual punishment and constitutionally impermissible. My staff and I jumped up and down in celebration. Moments later, we were flooded with calls from media, clients, families, and children's rights advocates. It was the first time the court had issued a categorical ban on a punishment other than the death penalty. I thought of my clients. Joe Sullivan was entitled to relief. Scores of people, including Antonio Nunez and Ian Manuel, were entitled to reduced sentences. 2 years later, in June 2012, we celebrated another major victory for incarcerated juveniles. The Supreme Court had agreed to review Evan Miller's case and the case of a client from Arkansas, Contrell Jackson. The outcome? A constitutional ban on mandatory life without parole sentences imposed on children convicted of homicides. This meant that no child accused of any crime could ever again be automatically sentenced to die in prison. There were more than 2,000 condemned people who had been sentenced as children to life imprisonment without parole. Now they were potentially eligible for relief and reduced sentences. Across the country, many prosecutors resisted retroactively applying the court's decision in Miller v. Alabama to old cases, but everyone now had new hope, including Trina Garnett. We continued our work on issues involving children by pursuing more cases. I believe that no child under the age of 18 should be housed with adults in jails or prisons. We filed cases seeking to stop the practice. I'm also convinced that very young children should never be tried in adult court. No child of 12, 13, or 14 can defend him or herself in the adult criminal justice system. Wrongful convictions and illegal trials involving young children are too common. I was encouraged by the fact that nationwide the rate of mass incarceration was finally slowing down. For the first time in close to 40 years, the country's prison population did not increase in 2011. In 2012, the United States saw the first decline in its prison population in decades. Our death penalty work had also taken a hopeful turn. We'd won relief for 100 death row prisoners in Alabama. In 2013, the state recorded the lowest number of new death sentences since the mid-1970s. These were very hopeful developments. We were able to finally launch the Race and Poverty Initiative I'd long been hoping to start at EJI. For years, I'd wanted to start a project to change the way we talk about racial history and how it informs contemporary race issues. We started working with poor children and families in Black Belt counties across the South. We brought hundreds of high school students to our office for fascinating discussions about rights and justice. Also, we worked on reports and materials to deepen the national conversation about the legacy of slavery and lynching and our nation's history of racial injustice. I found the new race and poverty work extremely energizing. It closely connected to our criminal justice work. So much of our worst thinking about justice is steeped in the myths of racial difference. I believe that there are four institutions in American history that have shaped our approach to race and justice but remain poorly understood. The first, of course, is slavery. and the second is the reign of terror against people of color that followed the collapse of Reconstruction through World War II. Older people of color in the South would occasionally come up to me after speeches to complain about how antagonized they feel when they hear news commentators talking about how 9/11 was the first act of domestic terrorism in America. An older African-American man once said to me, "You make them stop saying that. We grew up with terrorism all the time. The police, the Klan, anybody who was white could terrorize you. We had to worry about bombings and lynchings, racial violence of all kinds." The racial terrorism of lynching in many ways created the modern death penalty. America's embrace of speedy execution was in part an attempt to redirect the violence of lynching while assuring white Southerners that black men would still pay the ultimate price. Another practice that is not well known to most Americans is convict leasing. Convict leasing was introduced at the end of the 19th century to criminalize former enslaved people and convict them of nonsensical offenses so that freed men, women, and children could be leased to businesses and effectively forced back into slave labor. Private industries throughout the country made millions of dollars with free convict labor, while thousands of African Americans died in horrific work conditions. The practice of re-enslavement was so widespread in some states that it was characterized in a Pulitzer Prize-winning book by Douglas Blackman as slavery by another name. Racial terror and the constant threat created by violently enforcing racial hierarchy were profoundly traumatizing for African Americans, creating all kinds of psychosocial distortions and difficulties that still manifest themselves today. The third institution, Jim Crow, is the legalized racial segregation and suppression of basic rights that defined America from 1876 through 1965. It is more recent and is recognized in our national consciousness, but it is still not well understood. It seems to me that we've been quick to celebrate the achievements of the civil rights movement and slow to recognize the lasting damage of marginalization and subordination done in that era. The legacy of racial profiling carries many of the same complications. Once I was preparing to do a hearing in a trial court in the Midwest and was sitting at the counsel table in an empty courtroom before the hearing. I was wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and tie. The judge and the prosecutor entered through a door in the back of the courtroom, laughing and chatting. When the judge saw me sitting at the defense table, he said to me harshly, "Hey, you shouldn't be in here without counsel. Go back outside and wait in the hallway until your lawyer arrives." I stood up and smiled broadly. I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. We haven't met. My name is Brian Stevenson. I am the lawyer on the case set for hearing this morning." The judge laughed at his mistake, and the prosecutor joined in. I forced myself to laugh because I didn't want my young client, a white child who had been prosecuted as an adult, to be disadvantaged by a conflict I had created with the judge before the hearing. But I was disheartened by the experience. Of course, innocent mistakes occur, but constantly being underestimated, suspected, accused, watched, doubted, distrusted, presumed guilty, and even feared is a burden borne by people of color that can't be understood or confronted without a deeper conversation about our history of racial injustice. The fourth institution is mass incarceration. Going into any prison is deeply confusing if you know anything about the racial demographics of America. The extreme overrepresentation and disproportionate sentencing of racial minorities, the targeted prosecution of drug crimes in poor communities, the criminalization of new immigrants and undocumented people, the political consequences of disenfranchising black voters, essentially denying black people the right to vote, and the barriers to reentering the world after incarceration can only be fully understood through the lens of our racial history. It was gratifying to be able, finally, to address some of these issues with young people and the community. I became hopeful that together we might be able to push back against the suppression of this difficult history of racial injustice. A bigger staff, bigger cases, and a bigger docket also sometimes meant bigger problems. While exciting and very gratifying, enforcing the Supreme Court's ruling banning life without parole sentences for children convicted of non-homicides was proving much more difficult than I had hoped. Some judges seemed to want to get as close to life expectancy or death as possible before they would release child offenders. For example, Antonio Nunez's judge in Orange County, California, replaced his sentence of life imprisonment without parole with a sentence of 175 years. I had to go back to an appellate court in California and argue to get that sentence replaced with something reasonable. We met resistance in Joe Sullivan's and Ian Manuel's cases as well. Ultimately, we were able to get sentences that meant they could both be released after serving a few more years. In some cases, clients had already been in prison for decades and had very few, if any, support systems to help them reenter society. We decided to create a reentry program specifically for people who have spent many years in prison after being incarcerated when they were children. We would offer services, housing, job training, life skills, counseling, anything else people coming out of prison needed to succeed. We told the judges and parole boards we were committed to providing the assistance our clients required. In particular, the Louisiana client serving life without parole for non-homicides faced many challenges. We undertook representation of all 60 of those eligible for relief. Almost all of them were at Angola, a notoriously difficult place to do time. Angola, a plantation before the end of the Civil War, forced inmates to work in the fields picking cotton. Prisoners were required to do manual labor in very difficult work environments or face solitary confinement or other discipline. It was not uncommon for inmates to be seriously injured, losing fingers or limbs after working long hours in brutal and dangerous conditions. For years, prisoners who refused would receive write-ups that went into their files and would face months of solitary confinement. We decided to prioritize resentencing hearings for the old-timers, juvenile lifers who had been at Angola prison for decades. Joshua Carter and Robert Caston were the first two cases we decided to litigate. Mr. Carter had been in prison for 50 years. There he had developed glaucoma and didn't get the medical care he needed. He lost his sight in both eyes. Mr. Caston had been at Angola for 45 years. He lost several fingers working in a prison factory and was now disabled as a result of his forced labor at Angola. I traveled back and forth between the trial courts in Orleans Parish quite a bit on the Carter and Caston cases. The Orleans Parish courthouse is a massive structure with intimidating architecture. There are multiple courtrooms aligned down an enormous hallway with grand marble floors and high ceilings. Hundreds of people crowd the hallways, bustling between the various courtrooms each day. Hearings in the vast courthouse are never reliably scheduled. Frequently, there would be a date and time for the Carter and Caston resentencings, but it seemed to mean very little to anyone. I would arrive in court, and there would always be a stack of cases, and clients with lawyers gathered in an overcrowded courtroom, all waiting to be heard at the time of our hearings. Overwhelmed judges tried to manage the proceedings with bench meetings while dozens of young men, most of whom were black, sat handcuffed in standard jail-issued orange jumpsuits in the front of the court. Lawyers consulted with clients and family members scattered around the chaotic courtroom. After three trips to New Orleans for sentencing hearings, we still did not have a new sentence for Mr. Carter or Mr. Caston. We met with the DA, filed papers with the judge, and consulted with a variety of local officials in an effort to achieve a new, constitutionally acceptable sentence. Because Mr. Carter and Mr. Caston had both been in prison for nearly 50 years, we wanted their immediate release. There were two different judges and courtrooms involved, but we felt if we won immediate release for one, it might then become easier to win release for the other. Finally, it seemed we were close to success. After I'd made our arguments in the frenetic courtroom, the judge granted our motion. She detailed Mr. Caston's 45 years at Angola for a non-homicide crime when he was 16. She noted that he had been sent to Angola in the 1960s. Then the judge pronounced a new sentence that meant Mr. Caston would be immediately released. Then the people in the silent courtroom did something I'd never seen before. They erupted in applause. The defense lawyers, prosecutors, family members, and deputy sheriffs applauded. Other inmates waiting for their own cases to be addressed applauded in their handcuffs. Even the judge, who usually tolerated no disruption, seemed to embrace the drama of the moment. Mr. Caston was overjoyed. He became the first person to be released as a result of the Supreme Court's ban on death in prison sentences for juvenile lifers. We were thrilled and ready for the next case. We went down the hall to Mr. Carter's courtroom. Mr. Carter had a large family who had maintained a close relationship with him despite the passage of time. His mother was nearly 100 years old. She had vowed to Mr. Carter for decades that she wouldn't die until he came home from prison. To our great joy, we had another success, winning a new sentence that meant that he, too, would be released immediately. Mr. Carter's family was ecstatic. There were hugs and promises of home-cooked meals for me and the staff of EJI. Exhausted, I wandered the halls of the courthouse, waiting for one more paper to be approved to clear the way for the release of Mr. Caston and Mr. Carter. That's when I noticed an older black woman sitting on the marble steps in the massive courthouse hallway. She had smooth, dark skin, and I recognized her as someone who had been in the courtroom. I assumed that she was related or connected to one of the clients. She waved at me, gesturing for me to come to her. When I walked over to her, she smiled at me. "Sit, sit. I want to talk to you," she said. She had a sweet voice that crackled. I sat down beside her on the steps. "I've seen you here several times. Are you related to Mr. Caston or Mr. Carter?" I asked. "No, no, no. I'm not related to nobody here. Not that I know of, anyway." She had a kind smile, and she looked at me intensely. "I just come here to help people. This is a place full of pain, so people need plenty of help around here."
"Well, that's really kind of you."
"No, it's what I'm supposed to do, so I do it."
She looked away before locking eyes with me again.
"My 16-year-old grandson was murdered 15 years ago," she said. "And I love that boy more than life itself."
I wasn't expecting that response and was instantly sobered. The woman grabbed my hand.
I grieved and grieved and grieved. I asked the Lord why he let someone take my child like that. He was killed by some other boys. I came to this courtroom for the first time for their trials and sat in there and cried every day for nearly 2 weeks. None of it made any sense. Those boys were found guilty for killing my grandson, and the judge sent them away to prison forever. I thought it would make me feel better, but it actually made me feel worse. She continued. I sat in that courtroom after they were sentenced and just cried and cried. A lady came over to me and gave me a hug and let me lean on her. She asked me if the boys who got sentenced were my children, and I told her no. I told her the boy they killed was my child.
She hesitated.
I think she sat with me for almost 2 hours. For well over an hour, we didn't neither one of us say a word. It felt good to finally have someone to lean on at that trial, and I've never forgotten that woman. I don't know who she was, but she made a difference.
"I'm so sorry about your grandson," I murmured. It was all I could think of to say.
"Well, you never fully recover, but you carry on, you carry on." I didn't know what to do with myself after those trials, so about a year later, I started coming down here. I don't really know why. I guess I just felt like maybe I could be someone, you know, that somebody hurting could lean on.
She looped her arm with mine. I smiled at her. "That's really wonderful."
"It has been wonderful. What's your name again?"
"It's Brian."
"All these young children being sent to prison forever, all this grief and violence, those judges throwing people away like they're not even human, people shooting each other, hurting each other like they don't care. It's a lot of pain. I decided that I was supposed to be here to catch some of the stones people cast at each other."
I chuckled when she said it.
It reminded me of a talk I had given at a church meeting during the McMillan hearings. There were a few people in the African-American community who withheld support of Walter, not because they thought he was guilty, but because he had had an extramarital affair and wasn't active in the church. At the church meeting, I spoke mostly about Walter's case, but I also reminded people that when the woman accused of adultery was brought to Jesus, he told the accusers who wanted to stone her to death, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." Accusers retreated, and Jesus forgave. But today, our self-righteousness, our fear, and our anger have caused us to hurl stones at the people who fall down, even when we know we should forgive or show compassion. I told the congregation that we can't simply watch that happen. I told them we have to be stone catchers. When I chuckled at the older woman's invocation of the parable, she laughed too. "I heard you in that courtroom today. I've even seen you here a couple times before. I know you's a stone catcher too." I laughed even more. "Well, I guess I try to be." She put her arm around me and smiled back. "No, you done good today. I was so happy when that judge said that man was going home. It gave me goosebumps. 50 years in prison, he can't even see no more." She squeezed me a bit and then said, "Now you keep this up, and you're going to end up like me, singing some sad songs." She paused and grew silent. I heard her chuckle before she continued. "But you keep singing. Your songs will make you strong. They might even make you happy." People buzzed down the busy corridors of the courthouse while we sat silently. When I finally excused myself, giving her a kiss on the cheek and telling her I needed to sign the prisoner's release paper, she stopped me. "Oh, wait." She dug around in her purse until she found a piece of wrapped peppermint candy. "Here, take this." The gesture made me happy in a way that I can't fully explain. "Well, thank you," I grinned appreciatively. She waved at me, smiling. "Go on, go on." Epilogue. Walter died on September 11, 2013. He remained kind and charming until the very end, despite his increasing confusion from the advanced dementia. He lived with his sister Katie, but in the last 2 years of his life, he couldn't enjoy the outdoors or get around much without help. One morning he fell and fractured his hip. The hospital sent him home with little hope of recovery. He lost a lot of weight and became less and less responsive to visitors. He passed away quietly in the night a short time later. We held Walter's funeral at Limestone Falk AME Zion Church near Monroeville on a rainy Saturday morning. It was the same pulpit where, more than 20 years earlier, I had spoken to the congregation about casting and catching stones. It felt strange to be back. People packed the church and dozens more stood outside. I looked at the mostly poor, rural black people huddled together for this sad occasion, made all the more tragic by the unjustified pain and torment that had preceded it. I often had this feeling when I worked on Walter's case, that if the anguish of all the oppressed people in Monroe County could be gathered in one place, it could power something extraordinary, capable of igniting some righteous disruption or transformational redemption. The family had a large TV monitor near the casket that flashed dozens of pictures of Walter before the service. Almost all of the photos were taken on the day he was released from prison. Walter and I stood next to each other in several of the photos, and I was struck by how happy we both seemed. I sat in the church and watched the pictures with some disbelief about the time that had passed. When Walter was on death row, he once told me how ill he had become during the execution of one of the men on his tier. "When they turned on the electric chair, you could smell the flesh burning. We were all banging on the bars to protest, to make ourselves feel better, but really it just made me sick. The harder I banged, the more I couldn't stand any of it." He asked me once, "Do you ever think about dying?" "I never did before, but now I think about it all the time." He looked troubled. "This, right here, is a whole nother kind of situation. Guys on the road talk about what they're going to do before their executions, how they're going to act. I used to think it was crazy to talk like that, but I guess I'm starting to do it too. Well, you should think about living, man. What you're going to do when you get out of here, I replied. Oh, I do that too. I do that a lot. It's just hard when you see people going down the hall to be killed, dying on some court schedule or some prison schedule ain't right. People are supposed to die on God's schedule. The funeral service began. A choir sang. The preacher gave a rousing sermon that honored Walter and lamented that he had been pulled away from his family in the prime of his life by lies and bigotry. I took the pulpit next, taking a deep breath before speaking. I told the congregation that Walter had become like a brother to me, that he was brave to trust his life to someone who was as young as I was then. I explained that we all owed Walter something. He had been threatened and terrorized, wrongly accused and wrongly condemned, but he never gave up. He survived the humiliation of his trial and the charges against him. He survived a guilty verdict, death row, and the wrongful condemnation of an entire state. While he did not survive without injury or trauma, he came out with his dignity. He had stood strong in the face of injustice, a strength that just might have made the rest of us a little safer, a little more protected from the abuse of power that had almost killed him. I suggested to his friends and family that Walter's strength, resistance, and perseverance were a triumph worth celebrating, an accomplishment to be remembered. I felt the need to explain to people what Walter had taught me. Walter made me understand why we have to reform a system of criminal justice that continues to treat people better if they are rich and guilty than if they're poor and innocent. A system that favors wealth and status while denying the poor the legal help they need must be changed. Walter's case taught me that fear and anger are a threat to justice. They can infect a community, a state, or a nation and make us blind, irrational, and dangerous. I reflected on how mass imprisonment has littered the national landscape with monuments of reckless and excessive punishment and ravaged communities with our hopeless willingness to condemn and discard the most vulnerable among us. I told the congregation that Walter's case had taught me that the death penalty is not about whether people deserve to die for the crimes they commit. The real question of capital punishment in this country is, do we deserve to kill? Finally, and most importantly, I told those gathered in the church that Walter had taught me that mercy is just when it is rooted in hopefulness and freely given. Mercy is most empowering, liberating, and transformative when it is directed at the undeserving. The people who haven't earned it, who haven't even sought it, are the most meaningful recipients of our compassion. Walter genuinely forgave the people who unfairly accused him, the people who convicted him, and the people who judged him unworthy of mercy. And in the end, it was just mercy towards others that allowed him to recover a life worth celebrating, a life that rediscovered the love and freedom that all humans desire, a life that overcame death and condemnation until it was time to die on God's schedule. After the service, I didn't stay long. I walked outside and looked down the road and thought about the fact that no one was ever prosecuted for Rhonda Morrison's murder after Walter's release. I thought about the anguish that must still create for her parents. There were lots of people who came up to me who needed legal help for all sorts of things. I wrote my number down for each person and encouraged them to call my office. It made the journey home less sad to hope that maybe we could help. Since the Supreme Court's 2012 ruling banning mandatory life imprisonment without parole for children, nearly 2,000 people condemned to die in prison when they were children have been resentenced and now have a chance to go home. Nearly 200 people previously sentenced to death in prison as juveniles have been released. More than a dozen of our Louisiana clients who were sentenced as juveniles to die in prison are now at home. Ian Manuel has been released. Antonio Nunez has a chance to be released. And finally, Joe Sullivan has come home. Trina Garnett's sentence has been reduced and she's now eligible to be released. Her spirit remains strong. I continue to meet stonecatchers along the way who inspire me. and make me believe that we can do better than we've done for the accused, convicted, and condemned among us, as well as those who are victimized by crime and violence, and that all of us can do better for one another. The work continues. This is Brian Stevenson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Just Mercy, adapted for young adults, a true story of the fight for justice. This program was directed by Mae Wuthrich, executive producer Kelly Gilday. Text copyright 2018 by Brian A. Stevenson. This work is based on Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption, copyright 2014 by Brian Stevenson. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.